When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, my name is Andre Jack. Welcome to Millennial Money. I'm just doing this voice because I'm emulating Jeremy. His voice is lost.
We should all talk like this so Jeremy doesn't feel bad.
We should.
It's going to be a quiet episode. I'm usually the loud one that starts getting animated. So the fact that I'm talking quiet, it's going to be a really quiet episode. You better listen up, people, because we got important stuff to discuss today.
What happened to your voice?
I lost it.
Why?
Well, I think I got a little sick and then I kept making videos and videos. And remember last week on Millennial Money, I told you guys at the start, I said, you know, hey, try to talk a little more this episode. And then I think I still probably talked the most out of last episode. And next thing you know, Friday, I couldn't say anything. Saturday, I couldn't say anything.
So, oh gosh, what are you sick with?
You know, just a few things. It's nothing major, you know, of the realm
Don't
of things you
me,
could
I'm
be
just
sick
dying.
Well, is it contagious? I mean, like,
well, by contagious, that's a relative term, you know, I mean, could you get
Andre,
it?
Andre, do you want to change? Or maybe it's better I'm here because you're going to talk about it. Like
Be careful. You might end up like Jeremy with the last couple $100,000 left. And $100,000 worth of silver.
Pretty soon I'm going to start buying silver because Jeremy got the silver bug. I think that's what he came down with.
The silver bug. That's what happened. I got it.
You bought $100,000 worth of silver.
We criticized this the last episode. I didn't.
I know. No. I did it just to spite you guys because you were giving me so much crap about it. So I put $100,000 of my emergency money into silver. Okay, so everybody has an emergency fund, or at least I've always believed in this. I've been doing this since I was 18, 19, where I always had an emergency fund, right? And so of that emergency fund, which emergency fund should usually be cash. It shouldn't be stocks. It shouldn't be real estate because that's not like emergency money, right? That's like the last thing you should ever sell in your life, right? So, or crypto. So you're usually going to have a certain amount of cash. That's your emergency money, right? And so if you, let's say, have $1 million in your emergency fund, which I don't, I wish I had a $1 million emergency fund, but let's say you had $1 million. That $1 million over the next...
I'm looking at Andre's face. That we got Andre.
I already have a joke line, though.
Mr. Relatable here.
Okay. Let's say $10,000 emergency fund, okay? You
know, I'm going to take Andre's spot here. You know, like, that's some people's retirement goals. Okay. Like, you get $1 million and then withdraw 3%.
Graham's like, how do I get more like button smashes here?
Okay.
So $100,000 emergency fund. So like a month's worth.
Yeah. No.
A week.
All right.
Wow, we even got Alex laughing in the background here. Just all jokes today.
And thank you, FTX, for sponsoring today's video. We appreciate you. No, but let's say you got $10,000, okay? Your $10,000 over the next 30 years, buying value is going to go down immensely, right? So I was looking at like the value of a dollar since I've been born in 1989, which I'm an 80s baby, if you didn't know. Okay?
89 as well.
Oh, very nice. Okay. Yeah. Unlike some people that are born in the 90s, some poor people that might have been born in the 2000s. but anyways, 89.
Alex is not born in the 2000s.
Oh, really?
Okay. 95, whoops. Baby.
Oh, shoot. Damn. Wow, Alex. You're getting up there, man. Gosh. Have you thought about life insurance? Oh, gosh.
MetKevin.com/life. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, gosh.
We could keep that in there. I don't know. It's kind of funny.
Okay. Anyways.
I've watched so many videos that, like, instinctually every time I hear life insurance.
Coupon code.
You got $10,000, okay?
Okay.
So $10,000 in 1989. Is now basically worth at least 50% less in today's dollars than it was in 1989, right? Meanwhile, if you'd put that money in silver, let's say for instance, or gold, that money's at least around doubled. So let's say you'd put $5,000 in silver, your $5,000 worth now are $10,000. your other $5,000 of cash is really worth about $2,000 now. So the way I think about it is cash is a melting ice cube. So let me put a portion of my emergency fund over here in silver. And then the rest can be obviously in cash. And so let's assume I ever had to tap into my emergency money, which I've only had to do that probably three times in the past 14 years. And one of those times was when I started my real estate marketing company. So let's say I got to go into that. I'll go cash first. Then I'll go silver, like last resort. Mm.
So hold on. You mentioned 1989, $10,000 is worth $5,000 in purchasing power. How much is silver worth?
So silver's worth about double. So essentially, if you had $10,000 back then, let's say you're like, I got to divide this up, $5,000, just keep it in cash, $5,000 in silver. Now it's worth about $10,000. Mm. And then your $5,000 in...
$2,000 or $2,500.
Yeah, yeah, it's worth over 50% less in terms of the cash.
Got it. And then how liquid is silver? Like, how quickly can you get rid of it and convert it to cash in your bank account?
Right now. I could do it in a second. Yeah.
Well, you have to sell it and then it settles in a couple of days or it's...
Maybe. It depends on okay, you know, what preference you have with the brokerage or whatever.
It's interesting. I forget who mentioned this, but a lot of people treat like Apple in the stock market kind of like the gold standard where it's like it doesn't move a lot. It's not losing much value. And so a lot of people park their cash in just Apple and hold it there and then withdraw it just to stay liquid if they want.
Yeah. I think it's highly risky.
You think Apple's pretty risky?
Well, I think any stock... I don't care what you are. I mean, look at even Facebook. You know, Facebook fell 50% in a snap of fingers. For Apple to fall all of a sudden 20, 30, 40, 50% is not out of the realm of possibility. Like if all of a sudden they miss iPhone numbers and they miss iPad numbers and the sentiment goes negative, I've seen Apple many times fall 30, 40, 50% like that. It happens quick.
Right.
So,
yeah, but how long are you going to be keeping this as an emergency fund? I mean, I know technically it's like forever.
Yeah.
But how well does silver correlate against inflation? Because I'm looking back and it's like silver today is not that much higher.
Now, Jeremy,
if we go back to 2006, it was 1381 and today it's 23. I mean, has that kept up with inflation?
Yeah,
I don't know what the inflation numbers are back from 2006.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing for the most part.
Yeah, but if we go back to the last time period, we had massive inflation, which the only other time period we've had massive inflation in recent history is you go back to the 70s. And if you go back to silver in the 70s, silver went up over 1,000%. And I'm not banking on that. That's not why I put my money in. I want to be very clear about that because my 100,000 is going to grow into a million. If that happens, cool, dude. But that's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I believe the dollar will obviously decrease in value over the next 20, 30 years. And silver will more than likely, in my opinion, increase over the next 20, 30 years.
Here's the thing. Let's say you bought silver in 2012 at $31. You'd be less where you are today.
That was right after a massive bull cycle. There's two time periods in silver's history. It went through an epic kind of like Bitcoin type craze, you know, and one was back at right around 1980. It did this crazy spike up, and the other was right around coming out of the great financial crisis. If you look at, if you take those two time periods out, you know, out of the realm, silver's been fairly stable, but for those two freak time periods for like a minute, it went absolutely bananas.
So Jeremy, have you looked into I-bonds at all? That's a really interesting alternative.
But you could only invest 10,000 in I-bonds.
And it adjusts every 6 months to inflation.
Right. So you could do that, but it would be a pain for you to put in 100 grand because you could do like 10K for you, 10K for your wife. You could try to do like 10,000 through your kids if you pay. I don't know. I've seen some people get it up to like 50,000. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But just also, it's about to yield like 9.6%, which is insanity. Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and one other point I'll make, I don't want to harp the whole episode on silver, but I know you guys mentioned last episode, why not gold? Like why silver, why instead of gold? And it passed the industrial applications for silver, which is like EV, solar, and a bunch of other things. But if you look at on a historical standard, like usually gold trades at like a 40 to 60 premium, like 40 to 60 premium versus silver. Right now we're over 80. So right now I look at that and I say like gold is overvalued compared to silver.
It's overbought.
Yeah, exactly. And so in my opinion, and by the way, in the 2020, it actually went to 100-1, which was just insane. So that was completely unsustainable. So that's why I look at kind of silver as a better value in my opinion, but it's not like I'm going to make a killing on this. Mm. And I know the other thought process is Bitcoin, right? Like why not put that in Bitcoin? I still view Bitcoin as like, I want to make a ton of money. I'm going to buy Bitcoin. Bitcoin was created in 2009. We haven't seen Bitcoin go through decades and generations yet. And how that holds up, we don't know. So
That's a fair point. Yeah, you want to take less risk. And speaking of, a couple episodes back, you brought some silver with you. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a show and tell item here with me too.
Well, let me guess. You can take Pokemon. Some guesses. Is that your emergency fund?
I will tell you how much it's worth. Okay. Hypothetically, okay. You'll understand why I'm saying that. But it's worth $123,000. This what's inside of here.
$123,000, Andre. Yeah. You should have came over with a security guard.
Technically,
it's
there are two
chef in there. one day, hypothetically.
Yeah. Actually, there's two things in there. They're both about the same value, but there's two things.
Okay.
Anyway, if you want to take a guess throughout this episode, let me know. But speaking of, you said Netflix is just collapsing.
Oh my gosh,
what's going on?
Yeah, and Graham, you text us. How'd you see that?
I just happened to see it the moment it came up on. I was on CNBC, and then the little red bar came up at the top with the Netflix. So I saw it as soon as it came up, and then I texted it to you guys.
Wow.
Because I was like, wait, no, 25% it dropped that much. And it's at the same price it was back in now 2018. But I think it goes to show you they're seeing actually declining subscriber growth because they've raised their cost. A lot of people are sharing passwords, a lot of competition. I'm curious how much TikTok is eating away into that.
Ooh.
I am so curious because if someone has like 30 minutes to kill, are they putting on Netflix? Maybe not. It's easier just to scroll a little bit. I don't know. And lately the options on Netflix, it's you get a few really good shows, but a lot of it is just like scrolling. It takes like 15 minutes to find like something to watch.
Ooh. What's your perspective on that, Andre? Like, do you watch a lot of Netflix or like what's your go-to?
Maybe I'm like an older target audience here, but I watch a lot of Netflix actually.
Okay.
But that's not fair. I kind of use it to fall asleep.
Oh, okay.
You ever put on some movie and you just let a movie you've seen 1,000 times it's so much easier to sleep.
Oh yeah. I don't personally do that, but my mom was one of those. She'll put on the news or like Seinfeld or whatever, you know, when I was a kid and she would just be passed out.
I feel like it takes your mind off like the stress of the day and I don't have to like live inside my head, try to fall asleep and fight the demons. Yeah. So it's just a lot easier to fall asleep to just something else and trying to tune out a sound rather than trying to tune out a thought.
Yep.
It's a lot harder.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. Yeah, I like I said, I don't do that. I meditate. But at the same time, I understand, like, and I know Chris, my brother-in-law, he's one of those, he lived with us for a couple years. And all the time, you know, obviously I stay up like super late and I just hear his TV on still at like 2-3 in the morning and hear him snoring like, you know, he's completely passed out, but I still hear his TV on. And I
put a 1-hour timer. It helps. It's so useful. So useful.
I think some people, it's like if they wake up for a little bit and then they'll just like shut it off and it's like 3 a.m. or whatever.
Right.
So.
Wait, so just down 25%.
Yeah.
And the stock was already getting killed. This is a stock that was $700 a few months ago and it's 250 or so after hours.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if that's the bottom. Right. That's the craziest thing because the issue with Netflix, to explain this as simply as possible, is you have who invests in a company like Netflix is what's called growth investors. They're investing it because they believe it's going to grow to the sky. They just lost 200,000 subscribers. So now people are looking at it like, is this really a growth company or is this a company that's going to start shrinking subscribers and the pie gets smaller? And so you kind of get this debate of like, is this a short-term hiccup for Netflix or is this a long-term thing? And value investors are looking at it and they're like, I don't know if I really want to rush into this either.
That's why I've always kind of been afraid of growth stocks just because they can pivot on a dime.
They can.
It's a little bit more of a riskier kind of a perspective, but I don't know. I don't really touch much of tech anyway. Mm-hmm. I think it's been overvalued for so long. Mm-hmm. Like in 2020, I was buying a lot of oil when it was getting beat up.
Oh yeah, that was crazy. Yeah,
people are chasing Tesla and Netflix and Google and all those. And I just stuck with the dividend stuff.
Yeah. Oil, man. That's what we should have been buying. Remember when you could like, if you had somewhere to receive the oil or something like that, you could get paid when it went negative. Yeah.
I dumped a decent amount into Exxon when it was, I think, $40 a share.
That's really great.
And I remember I bought it and it kept dropping and dropping and dropping. Mm-hmm. And it was one of my worst performing investments for those few months afterwards. I think it dropped all the way down to like $30 a share, whatever. And I just forgot about it because I knew, hey, you know, it's Exxon. They're paying a good dividend. I'm just going to leave it alone. And I checked my account today. That same investment is up over 100%.
Yeah, that's insane. For a dividend stock.
Yeah, for a dividend stock.
You just would never expect that.
Yeah.
That's why I love dividend stocks.
Oh, yeah. Well, they outperform in a scary market. Like, for instance, I have my public account in the private stock group, and then I have a dividend account. Dividend account crushing my public account. And my public account has Tesla in it too, whereas the dividend doesn't. But there's just, that's the market we're in. Everybody's kind of risk off. No one wants growth stocks.
But you know what's funny? Dividend investors are not usually the kind of people to be like throwing their performance results in people's faces. They're not like, oh, it's true, beat you. They're more of the mature, kind of older folks, right?
Yeah.
Whereas like the growth stuff, I always associate that with like younger people who take more risk. And so they're more vocal about like, oh, I told you I was right. That's way better than the S&P 500.
Yeah.
And the dividend guys are like, oh, it's just you just wait. Well, it'll come back.
Yeah. Value's a little more, in my opinion, at least from what I've seen, they're a little more outspoken this time. And I think it's because they had those spec stocks thrown in their face and the meme stocks. And it was like, look at how much money I'm making. Right. And I think some of those folks felt maybe
good
a little
to be jaded.
Vindicated. Yeah, exactly. So I feel like they're probably a little more outspoken than they traditionally are. But yeah, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
And so right now, a stock like Netflix, for instance, they're trying to find like who's buying Netflix stock. Is it the growth investors or is it value investors? Or is it just there's no man's land? No, I haven't bought it yet. If it goes to a one in front of it, I might consider buying
it. What's it at right now?
About 250 after
$250.
Hours. Yeah, okay. 255 or something. I think it closed at maybe 258. Wow. So
I'm shocked that Netflix never allowed for user generated content. Just imagine if we could upload this to Netflix and then people could go on and be like, hey, just like Spotify is taking over a lot of podcasts, Netflix could take over whatever it might be. Just upload a video to Netflix. And I'm sure in the beginning they'd have like a pre-approval system where it's like they're going to get certain creators on there. That would do so well.
That's true. That's a good point. Fun fact, I've actually been on Netflix a couple years ago. Have you really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for Selling Sunset.
And Selling Sunset's coming out, by the way, with I think it's season 6 on April 22nd.
I watched the conference call interview thing that Netflix just had a few hours ago. They mentioned Selling Sunset on it.
No.
Yep.
Why?
Well, basically because they're asking about like you know, Netflix's future and those sorts of things. And one of the executives of the company was explaining like, you know, how several years ago Netflix wasn't creating their own content. And he brought out the example of like reality content. And he mentioned Selling Sunset on the executives.
I don't know if you guys have ever seen Nat Geo's Brain Games.
That's what you were on?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, I had like a whole episode dedicated to me. It was like season 2, episode 5, I believe it was called Brain Patterns. And I was showing magic tricks as a way to like demonstrate that there's a lot of discrepancies in the human mind. Yeah,
I'm going to check that out.
It's a fascinating
episode. Now I feel like we got to get into the dirty subject of compensation and what happened there, Andre.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting. I believe I got paid, mind you, this was like 2015, 2014. Okay. This was like 7, 8 years ago. I believe I was paid, so I was there for 2 days shooting in New York, and I was paid $5,000.
Wow.
So it was not much.
I know. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but
it's not much.
It's like considering how big that show was.
Right.
Jeez.
Yeah. I don't know if they had a lot of funding and a huge budget, but I wasn't like the main talent. They had a host, you know, so I was just one of the people they brought on as a guest, so... I imagine the host probably gets paid a decent amount.
And how much time did you have to spend and had that work?
Like two full days, yeah.
Ooh,
well, okay. My friends, Jerry Colbert and Adam, they produced it. They're awesome. They're super creative, yeah. So I at least got to make some longtime friends from that show.
Nice.
And yeah, it was cool to see the thought process and the creative like process of how to put all that together.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
Wow. Yeah, I always wondered, like, because some of these shows, I assume they kind of do them on spec, and then hope to sell it to a company like a Netflix or Hulu or whatever, right? Like imagine you want to make some sort of documentary
The pilot. So they'll film a pilot.
Okay.
And that's on spec. Mm-hmm. And then they'll take that pilot and pitch it to different networks. And the networks will sometimes get feedback. And then if one picks it up, they'll say, okay, we'll give this budget for this many episodes. Do your thing.
I see.
And the ratio of like the amount of networks they go and meetings they pitch is like 100 to 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane.
What?
They could pitch to 100 different sources and maybe one will pick it up.
Whoa.
Yeah, very difficult.
That's crazy. And so to get a bidding war, you would have to have something just insane, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
It helps to have a proven concept. Like if a show you're doing on Facebook or on YouTube or TikTok or wherever has a tremendous amount of viewership, then it helps to have that leverage when you walk into the
meeting. Even then, they don't want shows that cannibalize on each other. Like let's say HGTV already has a whole bunch of real estate shows. Right. They wouldn't want a Selling Sunset.
Right.
Or Bravo, they already have multiple real estate shows.
Right.
They would not a Selling Sunset. But so for Netflix to pick it up, it's like we don't have anything like that.
Yeah.
So not only does it have to be somewhat proven, but they also got to take the risk on it with a concept that doesn't compete with an existing show.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. Have you guys seen the Kanye West documentary type thing on Netflix yet?
I haven't seen his yet. No.
Oh, you have to watch that.
I heard it's really good.
It is so good. It's crazy because it's this guy who's filming him before he was like famous and whatnot. And through that whole like journey of like, you know, 2 years of like getting his first big album and whatnot. It was incredible, and I hardly ever watch that type of stuff, but I'm really into like documentaries and like, you know, the making of somebody that's going to be really successful. And then as it goes, he ends up kind of splitting apart from this guy that was filming him. Uh-huh. And to that guy, it kind of hurt him because he was from the outside looking in, essentially. And then they ended up meeting up again like 15 years later, and then again in 2020.
Wow.
And so this project was over 20 years in the making and finally got released on Netflix.
He made some money from that, though.
I hope he did.
Yeah, I think he
think about that 20 years he was sitting on all this footage, this classic stuff. And what was interesting about that is seeing other people that were successful at that time, their reaction to like Kanye's like verses or like whatever, and just like knowing like, oh, he's the one. And it's just incredible like how other successful people can spot other successful people and like that.
No, I remember Dave Chappelle talking about Kanye, and he was like, I knew him from the moment I met the kid. He's like, I knew he was going to be famous. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh yeah. One day his phone just rings. He picks it up. He's like, well, where you at? What are you doing? He's like, I'm recording.
Yeah.
My life's dope and I do dope shit.
Crazy, yeah. Man. But so we'll see what happens with Netflix. But the tough thing is, that was the first big tech company to report earnings, and such a bad omen to start the earnings season for big tech.
So
with them.
This is going to either age well or really poorly. Mm-hmm. But I'm nervous about saying this.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So I sold off a chunk of my Tesla stock.
Oh, okay. Can you tell us about your history with Tesla? Because I remember you didn't own it, then you owned it, then I think you sold off. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So when I bought the Tesla Model 3 in early 2019, I decided to put some money into Tesla stock because I loved the car so much. Like, as soon as I got in the car, I was like, this is it. I drove straight home and I put, I think it was like 10 or 15 grand into the stock. And that was back when it was $50 a share.
Wow. Okay.
Now this is like, you know, if you look back now, it would be the equivalent of $50 a share. Yep. And it did incredibly well. Now, the first time it ran up to $1,000, I decided to sell half because it went from like, back then, from like $200 to $1,000 in the span of like 2 months. And it had grown to an amount where, to me at the time, I was like, that's a significant amount of money. Mm-hmm. And I should at least just take some of it off the table so I lock in some profit. I could diversify that into something else. And I did. And then short term, I looked like a genius.
I remember that video.
Yeah. And everyone was like, oh my God, Graham called it, because I sold at the peak.
At the peak, yeah.
At that time. Yep. And it went from 1,000 all the way down to 600. And I looked like a genius, but I never bought back in. So it's not like I was able to capitalize on that. Then it ran back up. And then at $1,500, or it was $1,400 pre-split, I put, I think it was 150 grand into Tesla.
Okay.
But that was at a time where I was earning more. And so I felt, I love the company. Mm-hmm. I'm going to invest more into it. And then shortly after, I mean, this is luck, they announced the 5-to-1 stock split.
Mm.
And then it just went up. So I have two tax, and then I bought Tesla, you know, just in between there. But it was never like a significant amount. I mean, it was spread throughout multiple accounts. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I had an original tax lot that was worth, you know, in the low 100,000 figure.
Wow.
And that was like the original that I still had left over from that. And obviously I have other Tesla stock and other accounts.
Yeah.
So what was the $150,000? What did it grow into?
Oh gosh, like 400 something.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Right? Very nice. Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Nice.
I'm just trying to think of the original amount that I have in the account right now. So, something like that. Like
so
350.
Sold how much?
Low 100,000s worth.
Okay.
But I'm using that for a specific purpose. I don't want to reveal it quite yet, but it's you'll see it in a video in probably 3 weeks.
Is it real estate related?
No.
Oh,
probably car related.
But it's a good way to diversify.
Oh,
it's gonna make sense. When you see it, it's going to make sense. So either way,
I'm buying a Ferrari.
It's going to make sense. And I think, if I'm correct, this purchase, this other purchase is going to do just as well, if not better, I think, than the Tesla stock.
Okay. Is it a car?
Bet you it's a car. It's got to be.
You know. It's going to be another car, I guarantee you.
Well, if it is a car, it's going to do, I think, just as well.
Okay.
Hopefully. Okay. But we'll see tomorrow, because I see they have earnings tomorrow.
Okay.
And this could have, I could have made a huge mistake, because I've been watching the price of Tesla, and because I knew this was kind of coming. So I was trying to be like, well, you know, above 1,000 is not bad, but you know, it's not the, you know, 1,200 that it once was.
Mm. Well,
so we'll see. I mean, maybe it shoots back up tomorrow and people are like, "Graham, this is so stupid." Because I made the mistake once before selling it off, and maybe I make a mistake again.
After that original video, when you sold at $1,000, I remember the comments you got were like, "Oh, you're a genius, Graham."
Yeah, yeah.
And then when it dropped, when it went up again, did people call you out and say like, "Wow, you're an idiot"?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. It goes both ways. Yeah. Yeah. So if you go back to that original video now, it's like, this age like milk. Like, but obviously, you know, it's like,
see,
I did diversify that. I put that into the S&P. No, it did not grow as much as it could have. But, you know, in hindsight, you could look to anything and be like, you made a mistake here. But in the moment, it's like, that's the, I felt the rational decision.
Now, what if you, instead of buying that Tesla, you had put that money into Bitcoin and bought it through our sponsor today, FTX US, where you could buy it with no fixed fees. You can buy things like NFTs in their platform very easily. Take it away, Graham.
Oh, man. Okay, so anyway, guys, you could click the link down below in the description. You could sign up for FTX US. They're one of the largest US regulated cryptocurrency exchanges in the world. And like you said, Jeremy, there are...
fixed fees.
There's no fixed fees on transactions and no gas fees on the Ethereum and Solana collections. So the link is down below in the description. You could use our code and you will get free crypto on every trade you make over $10. I also love the fact that you could track over 10,000 different options of cryptocurrencies. And this was the app that I used to use back in 2017 when they used to be Blockfolio.
That's right.
And I've been using them now for years, and then they rebranded as FTX, but they've been fantastic. Zero complaints. You could dollar cost average into the markets as well. You could set up a recurring deposit. That's what I do. So it just makes it very easy.
And referral code MMFTX.
Correct.
Put that in so you can get your free crypto. That's awesome. When you make a purchase of $10 or more.
Down below in the description. So enjoy.
Thank you, FTX.
And yes, I could have done that. Now, what I also found interesting is that if you look back at some of the early Tesla car buyers, had you bought, let's just say, the $100,000 Model S, like fully loaded Model S back in 2012.
With the unlimited charging?
Yeah, like back in 2012, whatever the top model is. Now, how much that's, if you had, instead of the car, bought the stock for $100,000,
my gosh.
Do you know how much that would be worth now?
Probably a couple mil.
Think, Jeremy? Yeah, I would say 5.2 million.
You're way off.
10 really? Million.
19.
Wow.
Million dollars. Wow. $19 million back in 2012. Had you just bought the stock instead of buying the car cash outright.
Yeah. Wow. What if it's a more relatable number, like $1,000?
I mean, what would that be? 190 grand.
It'd still be crazy.
You would have
from a grand
from $1,000. Yeah, what about 190 times?
That's interesting. You brought that out because I have a friend and he talks about the original iPhone and he's like, I remember standing in the long line at Apple. And he's like, I was buying the first iPhone and he's like, what I should have been doing is buying Apple stock at that time instead of worrying about buying the newest iPhone. Just buy the dang Apple stock. Yeah,
I was listening to some interviews earlier today of like early Tesla drivers, like the first people, and a lot of them were told back then that if you like the company that much, you shouldn't buy the product, you should buy the stock. And so a lot of these early people were smart about it, so they said, well, I'm gonna obviously support the product, but I'm also gonna buy an equivalent amount of stock to support the company. And a lot of those people did incredibly well. So I think the same thing also applies to Apple. If you're sitting here buying an iPhone, put $1,000 as well. I mean, obviously if you have it, $1,000, but put that into the stock. I mean, between the two, you're probably better off in the stock.
Yeah, I remember looking into Tesla back then and considering it as an investment, and I was like, hell no, because they had mountains of debt back then. All car companies pretty much failed. They were losing crazy money, and you knew that. You know, like I knew they were going to lose money for like all, you know, so many years. Like, I couldn't even imagine a day when Tesla was going to be profitable back then. And this is like, I don't know, 2011 when I was looking into them. I think I was still living in Arizona back then. And it just, like, you were taking a massive risk if you were invested in Tesla. Now, the interesting thing is, I wonder if I would have taken that risk if I had more money back then.
Right.
Obviously, back then, I might have had a net worth of, I don't know, $20,000, $30,000 or something like that. So for me to, let's say, risk a couple thousand in a car company that was probably going to go bankrupt.
Yes.
And even Elon Musk says back then, like, he
and
thought
10% chance of actually succeeding.
Yep.
And 90% chance the company was going to fail.
Yep. So crazy success, but
Oh, my gosh. Oh, Jeremy, you thought about, so you're thinking about listing your house too, right?
Oh, yeah. But unfortunately, the neighbor listed, man.
Wow. Did.
So right, now.
Is it selling? But they listed.
They just listed
for how
this past
much?
Weekend.
No,
I can't say, but it's it's a lower number than I would have liked them to list.
Okay.
So my hope is it moves quickly. It gets multiple bids. They really did it nice. The inside looks beautiful. The decorations are beautiful. I'm hoping it moves quickly. And then, you know, maybe that would give me the confidence to list mine.
Why don't you call the realtor and ask if they have multiple offers?
Oh, find out the it's the same company. So the same company for the one I'm dealing with, she works for the same company. I don't want to name the name, but they work for the same company. So I already told her. I already told her she's supposed to give me information like how many bids they're getting.
Let's
like
find how much out information. Now. Call right now.
I'm not going to call right now.
Why?
No.
Call now and then you just ask. We'll edit around it.
6:36 at night.
As if that's a realtor, they're picking up their phone until 11 p.m. Guaranteed.
Hello.
Hey, my name is Graham. I got a quick question for you. I live kind of close by to your listing on. I am just curious how much activity you have on that, or if you see that selling over asking by any chance. Do you have any offers?
Are you an agent or a homeowner?
Yeah, I'm both. So I'm licensed, but I'm also a homeowner.
Oh, okay, cool. It's actually in escrow already.
We
just haven't updated the status because we're waiting for earnest money.
All right, cool. Well, congratulations. Is it over asking?
Not over.
Okay, got it. All right, well, very cool. I'll keep an eye on it online. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Cool. Thanks. Bye.
Wow.
There you go, Jeremy.
That's really cool.
I get so nervous like doing a call like that. I don't know. Maybe because I don't come from the real estate industry.
Oh, yeah. She could tell you're kind of like she's like, are you an agent? Because you have the agent speak.
Yeah, exactly.
What is the agent speak? Can you explain this to us?
I'm calling about your property on this. I'm just curious if you have an accepted offer on it, how much interest you have on it. That's agent.
Oh, okay.
Home buyers would be like, is it still available?
That's true.
All right. That's good to know.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah. Pro tip there.
Yeah.
Pro life tip.
Yeah. Have to
I was curious, how much activity do you have? Are you an agent? No, I just want to buy the house.
I saw a TikTok that said, if an agent says it's cozy, that means it's small.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's right. Can you show us or teach us some words that realtors use that kind of...
Oh, gosh.
The house has a nice personality.
Yeah.
So the funniest one is like, it's a handyman's dream.
That's a thing? Someone says that.
It's a handyman's dream.
Yeah, come bring your toolbox.
Oh, come bring your toolbox.
Perfect for developers is another one. No, a lot of it is just a lot of it's just
up and coming area.
Regurgitated words like everyone uses like spacious primary suite with spa like
Well, it's funny. Have you
bathroom
ever,
with you know?
Have you ever been in a restaurant where like you read the menu and it makes you salivate and it's like brioche with whatever and you're like you get it and it's like a piece of bread. Like what is this?
I mean, the thing is, it's like with the descriptions, I've always felt like sometimes they're a waste because everyone just looks at the pictures. Very few people will read the description. So the pictures I think are pretty self-explanatory and with like a tour, you kind of see what's going on. But yeah, a lot of it is just regurgitated words, indoor, outdoor, flow.
State of the art.
State of the
That's
art.
That's the best one.
Gourmet chef's kitchen. Right. I can't tell you how many times I've called that.
Gosh.
Soaring ceilings. Bright.
How much is an open house? Like how much does that help to have an open house?
It's more for the agent. I mean, I will say that I have sold houses from the open house. It's rare.
Mm.
The open house is more so for agents.
Networking?
Because you can meet, first of all the neighbors come in because they want to see it. get to meet all the neighbors, get a good impression there. And usually the way I've seen it is that if you get one listing, you should be able to get two more listings from that. Mm. So either buyers that will call you and you show them something else and like that's something else better, or another seller who calls because they see that you've listed in the area and they just want to know if you have anything else.
What if someone's aspiring to be a up and coming realtor? Would you recommend that to someone?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I mean, that's how I got started. I went to open houses mm-hmm. every Sunday. I talked to agents, and almost all of them were dismissive. And I kind of get why when you have like a kid coming up. You don't know how serious they are. But yeah, if it's a slow open house and they're not busy, absolutely. I mean, sometimes when someone's coming in when you have nothing to do and it's slow, it's like that's the highlight of the day because then you're like, finally, someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm. How long does it take and how much does it cost to become a licensed realtor?
So I'm almost done with getting my license actually here in Nevada, which is really cool. So far I've spent like $200 on the online classes. It's another $100 to take the test, another $160 for processing. So you could probably get all in under like $600,
$700. Wow. Yeah. I tried to get my girlfriend Corey into real estate and she was taking the course and they were making her watch those videos. And she's like, I just can't do this. It's so boring. I'm like, I know, but this is the boring part. Is that something you kind of dealt with? You have to watch these videos, and what is the point? You just watch the video, you take the test, and then is it kind of a series of that?
Yeah, so you could take these online tests. I think there's like six of them. A lot of it is just like you're never going to use this stuff.
And right, because the information, I looked at them, and I was like, this is so nuanced and complicated. I was like, this is not that complicated.
Yeah.
Or am I missing something?
Yeah, I mean, they want you to, they want to set a certain standard of like, you're supposed to be knowing these definitions and these legal terms, and like, what, you know, but a lot of it, you will just, first of all, you'll forget it as soon as you take the test. And then when you actually go through just becoming an agent and working as an agent, a lot of the stuff never comes up. And it's more important for you to know the contracts and be able to explain that to another person.
Mm. Well, what's the difference between a realtor like what you were when you were making 600 grand before YouTube? I remember you were making like $600,000 a year.
Oh, less, yeah.
And somebody who's just getting started, who's like, you know, doing it for their friends. Like what is the difference between, you know, like a world-class real estate agent and someone who's just like, okay.
Seriousness they take it. I mean, to a world-class agent, like every minute of their time is valuable and they will spend that networking and they'll do something and they want to grow. A lot of the other agents are so happy just like, hey, when a buddy wants to come along and buy a house, they're there, but they're not spending any time growing the business. It's like, they'll sit back and if someone comes up, great. But yeah, the good agents really spend a lot of time prospecting, and that's really what it is. Now, I was never a door knocker. I hated that. So my version of prospecting was posting lease listings online on Craigslist. People would call me from that, and I would just convert them to...
Sorry, can you explain a lease listing?
Yeah. So like just how you could list a home for sale, you could list a home for lease.
Mm.
And at least, I mean, it's been so long since I've done this, but at least when I first started, there was no competition for lease listings. Like no agent ever wanted to take a lease, and if they do it, it's as a favor to the homeowner because there's no money in it.
Right.
Like maybe you would make
like $150 or something.
No. Low end would be like $500. High end would be like maybe $2,000. But you have to consider it's just as much work to lease a home as it is to sell a house. So you could either make $30,000 selling a house or like $1,500 leasing a home, and tenants are just. You end up becoming a property manager too. So it's not like you just sell the home and it's like good and you move on to the next one, but it's also you lease a house, they call you. I've been trying to get a hold of the owner and this is broken and they won't fix it. What do I do? And then it's like, you don't want to be like, well, sorry, it's not my problem. You want them to come back. So it's like, well, I will negotiate that for you and I'll call this person and we'll get it fixed for you. So it's like, yeah, it's a lot of work to do that, but no agent wanted to.
Did you have a separate like phone dedicated specifically to real estate? And how late did you take your calls?
No, I had one phone, but like, what friends are going to call me? Like, first of all, they're going to text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll save numbers in my phone. So it's but like, how many phone calls do you really get from like friends? You just text. Mm-hmm. So it's, I don't know. Maybe that's just me. So anyway, if someone's calling me, they're a client.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would pick up the phone as late as I could. So if that's 11 p.m., that's what I'm saying, like 11, mm-hmm. like 6:30 is early.
Yeah.
For a good agent, they'll pick up their phone 24/7. They'll never let it ring more than a few times.
Wow.
This is like with her. I mean, the phone rang just like three times she picked up. But you could be out at dinner and like you pick up the phone. Like you have to do that, especially in the beginning. Like obviously, if you're a top agent and you have all the business you need, and you're selective and like, then you could be, then you could say, well, I'm not taking calls after 7. You could afford to do that. But when you're just starting out, like I'd say for the first 5 years, you can't afford to do that. Like you have to pick up the phone.
And when you started, did you worked for someone? You worked for a company?
Yes.
And what's the advantage of doing that versus being solo?
Yeah. So when I first started, I was working underneath another agent who was a top agent at the time in Beverly Hills. And so I, for the first month, I did nothing other than whatever he told me to do. I didn't care what it was. If he's like, like Sundays, I would spend hours going and putting up open house signs all across Beverly Hills.
Wait, step back. He was the top agent.
One of the top agents.
In LA.
Yes.
How did you get
that?
He was
like one of the top 100. When I was like 17, 18, I'd go to open houses, like I had mentioned, to talk to other agents, and I'd only go to the most expensive open houses I can find.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah.
That's
cool. So I figured, like, if that's what I'm dreaming of doing one day, why am I going to waste my time on these $500,000 homes when I could go and see the $10 million homes instead? So I would just, like, my bar was like $4 million and up, and I would just be like, I'm going to see all of them. And I forget how I found, I think there was like an MLS magazine or something like that I found that would show like all the open houses. And I just go there and like just highlight the ones. And I think this was like a print version.
So you approached this guy and you were like, I will do anything to work for you.
It didn't start off like that, but I basically went in for months talking to every agent, and I'd walk up and say, hey, my name is Graham. I really want to be a real estate agent. I'm getting my license right now. Like, I'm almost done with that. I just want to get your advice. Like, what's it like? How did you like get this listing? And I just talked to them. Most of the time they were not interested at all.
What are you laughing at?
I just imagine.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Graham. I'll do anything you want. No.
It was bad, but I...
It was bad. Oh, let's not leave with that.
No, wow. Here's the thing. Like,
I stooped to a new low, let me tell you.
Looking back, I cringe because I would get dressed up for these open houses, and I had no idea.
I've seen videos of you in a tux, and you were in like a Mercedes driving around.
But that's when I actually had like a nice suit on. This is before I had like nothing.
Oh, okay.
And so I wore this like really baggy button down. It was like, I had no idea how to dress at all, but I wore this really baggy like button down shirt. I wore these back then the style was like 2007-08, so like it was a little more like saggy, so I kind of wore these like baggy jeans. I had these oversized dress shoes, like the really cheap like $20 ones that you know they're really cheap from, what was that, not Payless, but like DSW, one of those outlets. So anyway, I mean, it was bad, like how I was dressed, but I would just walk up and talk to them, and most of them would be very dismissive and would just be like, oh yeah, no, I'd recommend you go to college.
Wow.
Yeah, you shouldn't do this. And a few of them were just straight up depressing. Like they're saying the market is over, like this is the worst time to get in the real estate. We had already seen the peak, so you kind of missed out on that. Everything is going down. Go to college and then come back in 4 years and then maybe the market will be better. And
this is 2011.
No, this is 2008.
Oh, 2008 when you were walking around.
Yeah, and then some other people were telling me that you know, the market was good, but now they have to get a job, like another job to supplement their income. So like, if you could go to college, just wait this out, just do that instead.
What changed everything?
I met that guy.
Okay.
And but I felt that like all those people were bitter. So I had this like really selective hearing where if they told me that, I'm like, then there must not be a good agent. So like, why would I listen to them if they're not good? So I just kept going to more and more agents. And then I walked into this place in Bel Air and talked to the agent. And I walked in asking these questions, but it was a slow open house. And we just talked for the entire time, like 2 hours. And then at the end of it, he's like, well, if you want to come down to my office, you could see what I do during the day. Or if you want to help me out, you can. And I think, what did I do? The next day, I went to his office and I bought like a big box of chocolates just to thank him for that.
That's cool.
And I left it at the front desk, not expecting to even see him. And then the lady in the front, her name was Connie. She's like, I could see if he's here and you could drop it off. And I was like, yeah, yeah. And so I saw him. He's like, well, if you're free this afternoon, just... And he had me just do BS work. I mean, it's like responding to emails, call this person, see if they're still looking for a home. And he had all these sheets of people who signed in for open houses. He's like, go down this list, follow up with everybody. And I did that. I'm like, hey, Sharon, my name is Graham from Coldwell Banker. And I want to see you came in this open house. What did you think of it? I just wanted to get some feedback. Oh, no, I liked it, but not for us. What are you looking for? And then I just get down what they're looking for. And he's like, great. Now I want you to find properties that fit that and email it to her. And I just did that.
Wow.
And then after that, I went in every single day. So no matter what he needed me to do, I did it. Like, so.
What separated him and made him such a good agent? What was that person's secret?
He was so friendly. Like, he was the type of person, he had a really thick Greek accent, and just people instantly warmed up to it. But he was also, he just was very charismatic. So like, I've seen him go into situations or people who are like so like put off and skeptical, and then within like a minute they're joking around. It's like he had this way about him that he could disarm people, and he's really well spoken. I think with his accent he could get away with saying like he had a more aggressive approach, and I didn't have that. Like if someone saw a house, you'd be like, okay, so you know, I don't want to do the accent, but like you know, he's like, okay, so let's put it, what price do you want to write the offer? Uh-huh. And be like, no, I don't want to write an offer. No, but we should put an offer. Low ball offer. And they're like, okay, maybe we should. How about the you know, write 1.2 million? And they'll be like, I don't know. He's like, 1.2. See if they'll say no, but just see. And but a lot of the times, like, you know, they'll love that. They like that he kind of pushed them a little bit, and it worked. But now I tried replicating that strategy, and I learned very quickly. When you're 18 years old with like zero confidence, you can't say like, no, we should write an offer on that. Like, so it was a steep learning curve. Yeah. But yeah, shortly after I found my niche doing leases.
You found your curve.
My curve was doing lease listings and basically just being someone's like grunt worker. Yeah. I mean, just anything that I could do. I mean, I was happy showing $2,000 a month apartments that made $400. Mm. And I took this so seriously. Like if they called me at 8 p.m., I pick up the phone. They want to see something. And looking back, like I took it too much to an extreme. Like I canceled plans. I had plans to like take a day trip one Saturday to Santa Barbara, and like somebody called me and wanted to see like a lease in the middle of the day, and I canceled that whole day just to show the lease.
Yeah. How did you get connected with the Selling Sunset guy?
Yeah. So Jason Oppenheim worked across if I'm working here, he worked like where you were sitting, just like a little bit further back. So he first started there in 2010, and he would do lease listings from time to time. I had no idea how to do them. So he would ask me, say, Graham, how do you do these lease listings? And I would, you know, show him and teach him that. But then also he had a very strong personality, and like I'd constantly hear him just like, he would get kind of loud sometimes because he's very like persistent. And so he will just, you know,
commanding.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he knew like exactly what he was going for. And he's like, he would just like, anyone who got in his way, he's like, no, I'm just going to get that.
Like, so he wasn't like the sweet, kind, like.
No, but so anyway, and I'll get to that in a sec, but no, not at all. He was the opposite of the other guy I was working with, like the polar opposite. So in the past, I thought like, oh man, you have to be like this accommodating to everybody. Like you have to drop everything. You have to like, you know, just whatever they say, you have to agree with it. And when Jason opened up the Oppenheim group, he had approached me and just said, do you want to come work with us? We just opened this office. And, you know, I'd love to bring you on the team. And at the time, like I felt so comfortable at Coldwell Banker and I really liked it there, but I felt like
let me interrupt real quick. What he did there, is that like a costly endeavor? It's not.
No, yes and no. He worked from his home. So like,
oh, okay.
His office before he opened up the Oppenheim group was in his living room, and it was just him. He started off with an intern, okay. It was him and an intern. And then the intern became a full-time assistant. And it was just him and her. And he would work from his, basically his living room was his office.
Okay.
And then once he started making money, then he opened up the Oppenheim Group.
And that's
when I joined. But it was interesting. But I felt like I had kind of capped off what I could do at Coldwell Banker because my income had been consistent, but it wasn't growing. And I just felt like I was doing the same thing on repeat. And it just, I knew there had to be something more.
How many years were you working there at that point?
It was 2000. No, I had been working there for about 7 years because I think it was 2015.
Oh, wow.
14 or 15 that I left to join the Oppenheim Group. I think it was 15, but it could have been 2014.
So about seven.
Six to 7 years, give or take. So I left to join the Oppenheim Group, and it was totally different. I mean, Jason was so just strong, mm-hmm. and his confidence was, to me, intimidating. Because he would have no problem telling clients off.
Was he a tall guy? Or he wasn't tall, right?
Or they were about the same. I like to say I'm taller, but technically I think he's a little taller.
Okay, so he's not like a huge guy.
No.
So I feel like part of that confidence and that bigger than life personality has a lot to do with like someone's physical stature. And it's interesting to see that that guy had so much confidence despite not being like a super tall guy.
Right. But I remember listening to him talk to clients and them being, you know, they would push back and he would stand his ground. Say, no, I disagree with that. We're not doing that. And the client said, but I want to do this. No, that's a waste of money. We're not doing that.
Oh.
And they would literally threaten to cancel the listing. And you know what? If you want to cancel, that's fine. But you know, no one else is going to sell it like I will. So if you want to leave,
wow.
Happy to let you go. He did not care. And versus the other, you know, what I was used to is just like, we'll do it. I'll listen to you. You know, don't cancel the listing. Let's keep it going. It's just a different style. But for Jason, it worked to be like really firm. And I remember too, if some clients wanted to list a house, he would turn them down. And I was shocked to hear that they would be like, here's the listing. It's a great house. I don't want it.
Why would he turn it down?
He doesn't like the house, or he doesn't feel like they're realistic, or they might be difficult. So he's like, it's not worth my time. I don't want to deal with the house. I don't want to drive up there. It's too expensive. It's not going to sell. Good luck.
Would he at least advise them and say like, try selling it for this?
Or, oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was always polite,
right.
But very firm. And I'd never seen someone be that, like, I don't want to say ruthless, but just very strict to the point. But people loved his honesty. Mm. And because he was like that sharp, people would respect him for that. And so when he disagreed with someone, said, no, we're not doing that. No, that's a waste of time. They, at first, sometimes will disagree, but you know, the next day, they would love him for that, honesty.
How did he get his hands on such expensive listings?
Networking.
Just networking.
I've never seen someone so good at networking. Like, I've tried learning from him, and I can't even do it. Like, we'll hold identical open houses, and afterwards, he'll say, Graham, you want to come with me to the, you know, we got two potential listings, and do you want to come with me to these listings? I'm like, what do you mean? We had like the same people that we send back and forth. Yeah, I know. I talked to this guy and you know, when we really got down to it, he wants to sell. So let's go to that one. And I talked to the same guy, but just the way he did it gets people to, and again, I think it's to get people to open up. And I think just his demeanor, his confidence makes people be like, yeah, you know what? Come over. Let's see.
You know what's fascinating? I could kind of make sense of that. And you tell me if I'm wrong on this, but it feels like the wealthier you are in life, the more that approach works towards those people.
Mm-hmm.
Like they just want a no-nonsense approach. Just tell me what it is. You don't have to waste my time. You don't have to be kind or nice to me. Just tell me what you think. And I think that resonates so much with people that are wealthier, generally speaking. And people that are less wealthy, I think they like to be catered to. They like to be sold the dream, right? And that kind of makes sense why the other guy's approach. But the other guy's approach, he was also selling multi-million dollar houses.
Yes. I would say between the two, Jason, by volume, sales volume was, I mean, way more successful. He sold way more. But he also had a vision of creating his own brokerage and really expanding in a way that a lot of people just don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Networking is crazy in that industry. The first time I ever realized that, I was like 16, and I had a friend whose dad was really successful in Arizona at real estate, probably had like, I don't know, 10 or 20 agents working under him, and went to a Diamondbacks baseball game and saw the dad in the first inning and the ninth inning. Never saw him the rest of the game. He was up in the boxes. He was talking with people. And I saw him at the very beginning of the game, very end of the game, the entire other time he was just networking with people. And I remember one time we went to Starbucks and he had an Escalade back then, which I thought was so awesome, like in the Escalade days. And I went to Starbucks and the whole time he was just talking with people in Starbucks and just networking and just like knowing people and then like getting to know this person and just starting conversations if he didn't know somebody. And it was just incredible because the way I imagine his mind work is just constantly everything needs to be, I need to make connections with people. And I don't know if that's healthy, to be honest, though. That it's kind of like, I don't know if you know, like the TikTok thing where people are like, because of social media, they view everything as a piece of content. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we talked about that. I talked about, like, you see a bagel and it's like, I got to make content.
Right. How do I make money from this and make a video?
It might have been you mentioned that. Yeah. And it's just interesting when you go so far down that rabbit hole. It's like, if you're just sitting there, it's like, what am I doing? I need to be talking with somebody. I need to make a connection.
Right.
Like, I can't just sit here and just drink my coffee.
Let me ask you a more kind of a conceptually philosophical question. How much of someone's success do you think is determined by luck versus how much they control?
That's tough. I mean, luck is obviously very important. Like, what country you're born into, you know, like who are you brought around? You know, as you grow up, is mm-hmm. it, you know, your parents you get to learn from and things like that. IQ could matter. I think definitely luck plays a part, but also I think it's the drive. But then you can say, do you get that drive because of external factors that were put on you, which then makes you driven mm-hmm. into certain ways? So,
right.
I mean, I think a lot of it is luck that than anything else.
Could you put a number on it?
Probably not. Okay. It's a big number, though.
It's a big number.
Yeah.
More or less than 50?
I'd say more than 50.
More than 50.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
I mean, you could be hit by a bus, you know?
Sure.
So what are the chances of being born? It goes back to the Gary Vee thing. It's like, what is the chance of being born? Like 0.000 is some crazy number.
Graham,
like,
what do you think?
Yeah, but I don't think we're going to count because all of us are born and is watching it. So it's already assumed that then it's like you're made born. It past that part.
Well, what do you think, Graham?
I'd say it's probably 75-80% drive.
75%, 80% in your control.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, I believe it. Because you could even think of it like a slot machine. You know, it's like, the more times you pull down on that lever, the more likely you are to win.
Mm.
And even though you might not win at the first one, if you keep going long enough, you will hit a win.
That's so fascinating that, like, your perspective and Graham's perspective, and neither one is right or wrong. Like, like my perspective, the way that I think about success and like life and what mm-hmm. determines someone's success, I'm on Graham's side, reversed. No. Like 90% luck, 10%
hard. Oh gosh, I think that discredits all the work that people put in to overcome the odds to succeed.
Man,
the
mental
endurance.
We can get into like our rabbit hole with this conversation. Maybe we want to save it for another episode.
Never.
But here's the thing: if you tell somebody that you think it's 80% luck, then why even try? Then it's just luck at that point. Like if you're going to tell someone. You could do your best, and at least that encourages them to move in the right direction. Or it's like, oh, no, it's just luck. And then it's like, well, then the people are more likely just to sit around and just like, oh, well, it's just that person was lucky. And then that discredits
everything. That's a great point. Yeah. And here's the distinction that I make that I think, Jeremy, it's cool that you are able to recognize this. Like, okay, so I was born in Russia, like mm-hmm. in a broke country. Right? Had I been born like one door to the right, I would have never even been able to leave that country.
Mm.
And now Graham is one of the smartest, you are seriously, like one of the smartest, ones, most successful people, and you got that way by working hard and being persistent mm-hmm. and all that stuff. So I'm not discrediting that. But I also think that, for example, you and Kevin, like people I look up to a lot, you guys had like the trifecta that I call the trifecta that was perfect timing and everything. It was the right asset class, the right timing, and the right location. Let me start. If you were, for example, if you got into real estate in like 05, 06, 07, you could have easily been discouraged enough from ever pursuing it again because you faced this big crash. But even before then, another leg of this three-legged stool, I suppose, is you were exposed to the right thing at the right time. Like, for example, growing up from, you know, gymnast parents, everyone, not just my parents, but like everyone around them, they were living paycheck to paycheck, and that was just like normal life. You didn't even ask if this was normal or not. You just did it. I didn't even know you could build wealth, let alone with what, right? And so I think the fact that you were exposed to a path that allowed you to even question and ask the right question is luck in and of itself that is beyond your control. So number one, you were exposed to a path to wealth that I think a lot of people, most of the world, does not get exposed to. Mm-hmm. Number two, you got into it at the perfect time, 08, at the bottom, almost, right? Had you done it a year or two earlier, hold on.
Okay, I'll leave.
Second stool, right? Yep. So the right asset class at the right time. Third, in the right location. What other place in the world could you name me
that you could have had that trifecta or with real estate and made that much money. Like literally, maybe no other place in the world could you have gotten into real estate and made that much money.
New York, San Francisco.
One place, I mean, two places. In the world, Vancouver, though.
Dubai.
LA, then LA, really? You're comparing that to like LA and Beverly Hills? There's no way. So, okay, hold on.
I think, yeah.
Hold on. Yes. Now, I am not saying that if you had transposed you and I, right? I'm not saying that I would have had that same success. I think you could drop someone else with a different personality trait, like me, for example, who was raised to be told not to take risks. Like, I wouldn't have even done it, even if I had your circumstances, right? Like, I'm giving you the credit for the fact that the way that you are, you capitalized on it, which not everyone, I think, was able to. I'm telling you, I don't think I would have been able to capitalize on it, maybe. So the circumstances you had, I think, led you to build that momentum to realize the person that you are now. Now, if you don't have that momentum on your side until you're 60 or 70, when you realize, like, oh, this is how it works. Like, yeah, you could say at that point it's hard work, but, like, you missed it. And it's those first stepping stones that really gives you that momentum to be exposed to the success, to the hard work, to all these concepts that I agree with you are the difference between make or break. But it's the other things that are far beyond your control, like where you were born, how you were raised, what you got into, when you got into it, that I was not able to do. And yet we still came to kind of the same conclusion. We find ourselves in the same industry because of something we shared. Was it something our parents told us? Was it something we heard? Was it something we saw? Was it the right question? I don't know what it is. But that's why I think, to me, like, a lot of people's success, especially in the early stage of their life, is determined like 90% by luck. And yet the other 10% that really tips that grain of rice that tips the scale, that's your work.
But the other thing is that you have people with way more resources who should be way luckier who don't do anything.
True.
And they just waste it all. I don't think resources, I mean, there's certainly things, what I would say probably the luckiest thing is being born into a family who is supportive and they weren't abusive and they didn't suffer from, the addictions. And there were a lot of things growing up that definitely gave me that sort of confidence that I felt like no matter what I pursued, it would be good. But to say that like real estate was the perfect timing back when I started, that was the worst timing. If you're talking about, in hindsight, you could spin it in a way that was good timing.
No, I think it's objectively the best timing.
2008 to start as an agent, that was right at the peak of the market as the market was going down. The first 4 years of my career, every year the market was going down.
Right.
In hindsight.
But you were buying at the low point.
4 years later, but that was assuming I even made any money as an agent.
Yeah, but I think you could have thrown money into almost anything starting 08 after the crash and made
everyone
money.
Told me it was a bad idea. People told me it was a bad idea to start real estate.
They're in
because
yes.
Everyone.
But that's why I'm giving
burnt.
You. That's why I'm giving
people
you the credit.
I know, but people also told me 2011, 12, bad time to buy real estate.
Right.
It crashed. People in 2015. Why do YouTube? Everyone else is on YouTube. No one's on making finance content on YouTube.
True. But these are all like circumstantial. Like not circumstantial. I'm sorry. They're subjective. They're your thought process. Whereas like the events, objectively, historically. Were the best time. I'm not saying like you didn't encounter pushback.
I think there are always opportunities out there. And I just think it comes down to the mindset to spot opportunities when they're there. I agree with that. If it were not YouTube, if it were not real estate, if I had started earlier, there would have been another opportunity to seek out.
Right.
And even right now, I'm sure there are opportunities that people are jumping on. It's like, that's the perfect time.
But there are people, I bet, that are watching this video in some parts of the world that can take everything you're saying and they will get nowhere near as far as they could get if, let's say, they were born in a certain location here in the U.S.
But what are you going to do about it?
Exactly.
So why focus on it?
We have to acknowledge that.
But if something is not going to serve you, I've always taken the approach.
Right.
Why put any mental energy into it? Why say if it doesn't do you an advantage to say, well, I'm not lucky because I wasn't born in this. So if that pushes you back in any way, why not focus on what you can control?
I don't think it's as much of advice that's meant to push anyone back. As much as it is to be forgiving to yourself if you don't find yourself in a place that you want to be. And that's not to say like don't work hard, don't push. It means if you're not at that place and you're not a multimillionaire or whatever you want to be, perhaps recognize that we started life at different points in the race. Mm-hmm. Things that were far beyond your control. And I think acknowledging that is to realize that there's a bigger world than just the US. There's a bigger world than just LA. And that's kind of what I'm trying to say is like, yeah, we can cater to people that watch us, but they've already won the lottery, genetically speaking.
Yeah, I think you got to view it on a person-by-person basis. And I think somebody's got to be proud of what they achieved.
Right.
For instance, I know we've talked about the gentleman that founded FTX, right?
Yeah.
You know, if he lived our lives, he might be in depression. You know, like literally, like imagine how poor we are to him.
Right.
Like we're so insignificant.
Away. He's giving away all
his
money.
Yeah. And he could give away 99%. He would still be richer than all three of us combined by an exponential amount. Sure. Right. And so think about that for a moment. But he started at a different level. And so we shouldn't feel like we stink because we're not him.
That's kind of what I was trying to say. $30 billion.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so I think you got to view it as like where you were at, be proud of yourself. And it doesn't mean he was necessarily smarter than us. It doesn't mean he worked harder than us. It's just a different circumstance.
Right.
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 And so that's where it gets into luck. And so maybe it's something like a 50-50. You know, maybe.
Right.
Cause maybe if we were in his shoes, we would have executed on that and now we'd be worth $30 billion or whatever in climbing or maybe we wouldn't, you know, can't really play it.
Therein lies what I'm saying to Graham is that even though my perspective of the world is that 90% of people's success is based on chance and the ability to capitalize on it. That is not to say that if you were to transpose a normal person or the average person, or let's say even me with Graham, that I would find his success. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm trying to say. So I think there are things that also we are born with, whether it's intellect, whether it's talent or whatever it is, or the physique that gives us the confidence and the ability to do certain things. Mm-hmm. Like you said, with Jason Oppenheimer, perhaps he was born with an ability to capitalize on that success that built on itself.
Yeah, but I didn't think I could make YouTube videos.
No, me neither.
Yeah.
Me neither.
But it goes to show you that over time, if you have a passion for something and you're really into it and that's what you focus on, you could do it.
100%.
Obviously, I'm not going to be a basketball player, 100%. But I didn't have an interest in that.
Right.
So I think it's more worth it for people to focus on what they can do right now today than it is to focus on any shortcomings.
Well, I will agree with that too. Yeah, I will agree with that. Okay. I'm not saying that let's promote mediocrity and like you don't have to do anything. It's just, everything is a flip of the coin. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I think it's nice to be objective and realize that so much of our success was built on predetermined things.
Yes, but it's hard to ever say something like that because yes, that's true. But then why don't if that were that much of a determining factor, then why don't people with more have more success
for the same reason that I told you
less, have more
for the same reason that I told you if you switch places with me and I would have had your life I would have not necessarily had what you have. Mm-hmm. That's exactly in reverse what you're saying.
Yeah,
because we are born with different upbringings and things that certain people capitalize on and certain people think is a too big of a risk to take.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe they don't value that. Right. So you know
that's a great point. So,
maybe they don't value money. Yeah, so it's like, why do I care to make a lot of money? Yeah. Like that's not my drive. Right. I want to, you know, enjoy weekends off or vacations or family. Yeah. And so just different people have different values too. Right. And we shouldn't just say, you know, you're not successful if you don't have a certain amount of money.
Yeah. Right. No, exactly. So,
you don't have $1 million emergency fund, Jeremy.
A month's worth.
$100,000 in silver.
Oh yeah.
Should we find out what's in the box?
Yeah. I would love to.
Guess what's in it.
My guess is Pokemon cards, but I bet it's not.
Okay.
123. I don't have a clue, dude.
The other thing, it could be some sort of precious metal. But I don't know why you'd be carrying it in that box.
I don't think it's a precious metal.
What else could it be?
I don't know.
It's not Pokemon. It's not Pokemon, but you're close.
Oh, then it's probably platinum. Oh, you know what it is? It could be coins. No, it could be rare coins.
Watches.
No,
it's just not watches.
This is really heavy. Oh.
Diamonds?
Jeez. Oh my gosh.
It's gold. But
come on.
How much gold? 999 grams. How much is that worth?
I don't know. But that's a lot.
It's worth this much, Jeremy.
$60,000. Oh.
Which is also not real money, but I just wanted to illustrate what that would look like if you owned a piece of gold.
Come on.
What, did I let you down?
I thought you had something. I was like, really? I was like, wow, you really brought some $123,000.
No, I said hypothetically how much it would be worth.
Oh, shit.
I'm not about to bring $100,000 worth of stuff.
No, that's why I was like, dang, man, you should have a security guard.
This looks like good money.
Right? It's great.
Yeah. Motion pay. Is this this might be the same money that I have. And props we trust.
Sweet trust.
Oh my gosh.
But for anyone who doesn't know what it looks like, because I've never taken out cash, but this is 10 grand right here. Yeah. This is what that looks like. Yeah. So you invested 10 of these into silver. It's so crazy.
And then you'll get five back.
Yeah, I imagine.
I love
visualizing. 10 years is worth $10.
I love like looking at things and just visualizing what it actually looks like. Mm. Like if you look at how much a person earns in a lifetime, if you were to like put it on a table, it's so much less than people envision it to be.
I see what you're
saying. It's just it's a weird way to look at life when you like visualize what you're trying to aim for. You're like, wow, that's all this is, and maybe that helps trick your mind into thinking this is not so hard. I get it.
It's like the days before credit cards and debit cards. You know, now we're so used to paying with that, we never see the money transact. Back in the day, imagine you got to carry cash to pay at that restaurant.
Dude, I remember like taking a 20 out, and I'm like, oh, that's so much money for this.
Yeah.
And now it's like on a card, you're like 200. That's whatever.
It's like, I don't see it.
Yeah. I don't know. Gosh. I think it's a cool way of thinking about it, but I just wanted to illustrate.
That's cool.
Yeah.
But I'm still disappointed.
I'm sorry it's not like real $100,000.
I thought it was something like, oh, well.
Hey, we should all bring some stuff every week and do a show and tell about it.
Next week, it's your turn, Graham.
Yeah.
Your turn.
Gersperms.
Gersperms. Oh, yes. Yeah, so you saw the books.
I did.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Is that cool?
Oh, my God. So Graham and I go out to sushi, and he's like, okay, I got this thing, but you can't buy it. If I tell you what it is, you can't. I'm like, what is it? Mm-hmm. And he's like, you have to promise. I'm like, I'm not going to promise. What did you buy?
But
he's
you had to promise.
No, you have to promise. I'm not going to tell you unless you promise. And I'm like, all right, I promise I'm not going to buy it. He's like, and I'm thinking like, oh, he just like bought some like crazy thing. He just bought some Pokemon crazy. And he's like, I bought a set of Goosebump books. And
I'm like, mint condition. It took me a long time to find him at a good price, though.
Was I there? Because I feel like I remember this conversation.
No, you didn't.
Okay.
No, you weren't there.
No.
And you showed me, I think, on your phone, like the collection. Yep. Like, wow.
Because this is months ago now.
No.
This was like a year
ago. It was a while ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah, it took me like 4 months to find a good set at a fair price that was not worn. Because a lot of people open the books.
Yeah.
They have like edged hairs or whatever.
Okay.
So I found a perfect set, 1 through 62, of Goosebumps, the original Goosebumps books. I got them framed.
How much was it?
The set was under $500, but every other set that I saw in that same condition was $800 to $1,200.
Oh, wow.
So when that came up, I just made an offer, immediately got it.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So already I've made money.
Wow.
But the frames were more than the books, though.
That's
the downside. To me, it was like it's a work of art.
Is that like a local company you had to do that? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Okay. So they had to custom make this frame. It's, I think, like 2 feet by 2 feet.
I feel
feet
like the frames cost more than the books.
That's what I just said.
Oh, you just said that. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
I missed it. Jesus.
Yeah. Because they don't have frames for books. Because my big thing was that I did not want the books to be damaged at all. And I wanted them to be protected from the sunlight. So they.
Yeah. So technically, you lost money on it.
The frame has value, wouldn't it? I think if I put these up for sale,
okay,
I would get more than I have invested into
it. If people knew who was selling it, maybe.
Well, maybe I use that to my advantage.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
But here's the thing, though. It's not necessarily that, but it's also the exposure that I'm able to give the books. If I wanted to sell them, you get like 100,000 people seeing it versus an eBay listing where people only see it if they're looking for it.
Right. I don't think I've actually read a single Goosebump book. I remember seeing them growing up.
They were super cool.
But I remember reading the Animorphs. I don't know if you guys remember
that. Like the knockoff Goosebumps book. And like, I hated those covers.
I never read those yet. But I remember the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the 3-series book. I bought that.
Yeah.
That's actually really cool.
With the scary pictures.
Oh my God, they're terrifying.
I did not like those.
Yeah. Those are cool, though.
Yeah. But the Goosebumps books, I mean, I don't know what they're going to be worth one day. Probably, you know, not like a first edition Lord of the Rings.
Right.
But I think it's neat. And I just think it's a work of artwork because you could look at it and it's like, I had all those books as a kid. And it's just so cool to see the imagery and like, the artwork is incredible.
Yeah, that's really cool.
All right, this is a portion of the show, Andre, where you tell Graham he lives a high-flying lifestyle.
and then I'm
Alex is
and how everyone is out of touch and how lucky.
Yeah.
How it's all luck.
How dare you take away from my effort?
Yeah.
No, I think we all work really hard.
Yeah.
We all work really hard. And sure, you might say we deserve where we are, but at the end of the day, I think there are circumstances beyond our control that it's okay to be forgiving towards yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, work for the best, hope for the best, work for the best. But you know, don't expect crazy things to happen.
Unless you're going after that.
Yeah. Even then, I think, you know, even with YouTube, like, even though I've worked insanely hard and sometimes I don't sleep until like 4 a.m. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I probably outwork 99.9% of people, but still I attribute a lot of the success on YouTube to, luck in the sense that I had the necessary prerequisites and mm-hmm. skills as far as storytelling, cinematography, a passion about money, which is inarguably the most important topic in 2020, 2021 of YouTube's entire career.
Yeah.
Like finance. That was the years of finance. Mm-hmm. And to be there at the right place at the right time, knowing and having the right skills, even though all of those skills took me busting my butt, it still was beyond mm-hmm. my control. And there are lots of talented people that I know who are friends of mine that are world-class singers and dancers and acrobats, and that mm-hmm. they're like amazing and really hard workers that
yeah.
really haven't gone anywhere, and they have an incredible work ethic.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's important to realize certain things like that. And it's not to say like, I want to promote mediocrity and just like sit on your butt and do nothing.
Yeah.
But I think it's okay to be forgiving and, you know, kind of understand an objective perspective.
100%. I love that. There was a good point I was going to make, but I forgot it again. Always forgetting the points I'm going to make. I think I got dementia at 32 already.
Dementia. That's why you like Warren Buffett.
Oh, I love Warren Buffett. Thanks for reminding me how much I love Warren Buffett. No, Warren.
Yeah,
Warren,
forgot about that.
Warren. Yeah, I forgot how much I love Warren Buffett. Did I ever tell you about him? No, Warren Buffett once said, he said something great. He said if he was born, you know, a few hundred years before
yes.
in a jungle or something, he would have been eaten by a lion.
No, exactly.
Of one of the richest see, people in the world. I feel,
exactly. That's a great way
to look
at it.
That was him and Jay-Z that were talking side by side. Coming entirely different upbringings, but both equally, well, not necessarily equally successful, but very similar levels of success. Yeah.
But I love what he said in that conversation. He said, the reason I'm so wealthy is because society decided to put a high value on something that I was good at.
Yeah.
And if I was good at something else, it wouldn't have valued it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, again, getting into the weeds, I'm not going to get into this, but like...
This is the point I was going to make is, you know, sometimes I even wonder this. I wonder if, you know, the things I'm doing now are actually holding me back.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, you know, from like, so essentially,
like buying silver? Like,
yeah, that's every stock I own. No, I'm just kidding. No, but like YouTube and like the whole thing I'm doing, right? Like everything I put my effort into on a daily basis, if that's actually holding me back, and I could get far better, if you like took away this and essentially I could focus on the next endeavor, right? That's a huge opportunity.
I've always been a firm believer that, if you've got something good, you keep it. You work something on the side. If the side takes off and it does better than the main thing, do the side thing.
That's mm-hmm. interesting.
That's always what.
But the thing is, we're so busy now, we don't have time for side things. So that's the issue.
Because there's
no way we could start a side thing now.
I wish I could have done it like Graham did. Like he grew a business alongside an already successful business, whereas mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. I jumped out of the airplane and I'm not saying
you're
that this
doing
is a
well.
I was doing okay. I actually quit my job in 2017, and for 2 years I was just depressed. I got out of a relationship, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I was approaching 30, and I was like, dude, I don't want to be that 30-year-old that's like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore.
Yeah.
And here I had this identity that this character that I've built for 30 years of my life, mm-hmm. who I thought I was, and at 28, I was like, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I have these skills and passions, and I mm-hmm. applied to like 50 jobs. I didn't get a single interview.
Wow.
And I was like, well,
interview?
I didn't get a single interview. And I was like, I guess I'm going to have to create something for myself. And jeez. I gave myself 1 year to do YouTube. I rejected every single work offer, every gig, everything. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, I filed for taxes. I made like 10 grand in mm-hmm. 2017, like legit.
Yeah.
10 grand.
Wow.
I was living on probably like $500 a month, maybe. Okay. So I was living very, you know, it was a very slim lifestyle. So, yeah.
Did you have your current girlfriend back then? Or?
I did.
Okay,
I did.
You did.
Yeah, and she was so helpful throughout it all. But it took me 2 years to build up the courage to do YouTube.
Wow.
And then I gave myself a year. In January 2019, I was like, I'm going to do this for a year. And if it doesn't work, I'm going to move in back with my parents as this 30-year-old loser who's going to be living with his parents, which I think is the wrong perspective to take. Yeah. But I think sometimes we're our own worst critics. And mm-hmm. sometimes I think it's good to be more forgiving to yourself because I think it's more conducive to living a life that's a little bit more fulfilling rather than like criticizing yourself. So in 2019 I started and I gave myself a year, and if it failed, I would have just like gone back to school and done mm-hmm. something. But anyway, the Warren Buffett thing
where
we talked about, that's why I don't distinguish genius.
Yeah.
Because to me, whatever someone's good at is an equally worth pursuit. Like if someone's a world-class swimmer or a gymnast, that is no different than if you're a world-class, I don't know, a rocket scientist. Yeah. Yes, society puts a different value dollar-wise on those skills. Mm-hmm. that's, I think, beyond our control.
Yeah.
But when people are like, that person's a genius, I'm like, how is that more of a genius than like an expert magician? Like, that's what you spent your life getting good at.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, how is that any different than a dude who spent his life studying math and rockets? Cool. You're good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Society values the guy who does the rocket stuff because he makes more money. But to me, I don't see any difference in terms of worthwhile pursuits.
And if you really want to go down the luck rabbit hole, then you could go into like people you happen to know, family members or friends. You know, they always use the Jeff Bezos wife example, right? Mm-hmm. She became obviously super rich and she was married to him. And it's like, well, how much did she help or not help?
Right.
So yeah, you could get into a lot of debates there, but I think we kind of beat the dead horse there a little bit. So.
But it sounds like you feel like you're holding yourself back, Jeremy.
I think I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. Cause like sometimes I think it's so hard when you're in this thing, right? And you're like doing all this, but you can't untap from that really, unless you have to like really like let go of it all. And that's a tough decision to make. Cause then you like let it go of it all.
Well, it depends. Is the thing you want to pursue in line with what you're doing now?
I don't know, but can't even see it though.
Okay.
Because you're in it.
By it's quitting, you're going to see other bigger opportunities that are out there that you can't see right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when you're so in it, there's just no way. Like Graham's so busy, there's no way he could see an opportunity right now that would be massive. Because he's got to worry about Millennial Money and then the podcast and then his other channel and then his other channel.
Poor Graham.
So, no, and it's great, but who knows? He might have a multi-billion dollar idea that he just can't execute because he doesn't have the time to there.
But I think if I did think of that idea and I thought it had potential, I would cut something to put some time into that, and then if it takes off or it, you know, if it doesn't do anything, it doesn't do anything. But I think, I don't know. I'm more curious of what I would do if I wasn't doing YouTube, and that thought crosses my mind from time to time. Like,
you'd be a drummer.
Well, yeah, but like I couldn't drum all day, so it's like, you know, I don't know what I would do if it wasn't for this, but I don't know. Make sure to subscribe, by the way, hit the like button, and until next time.
Peace.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.